طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature a presentation by Shayna Lowe, just back from working the summer as a legal intern with the NGO Badil in Bethlehem. Badil is the resource center for Palestinian residency and refugee rights. Shayna is not new to advocacy for Palestinian rights. She has traveled to the West Bank 10 times, staying for as long as a year working with the Freedom Theater in Jenin. Shayna grew up in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and attended the Lincoln Public Schools. She graduated from Columbia University and is now beginning her second year at the SUNY Law School in New York. This presentation was given at the Lincoln Public Library to a packed house. Here is Shayna Lowe giving her report from Bethlehem.
Thank you all for coming. It really means a lot to see so many familiar faces here and lots of faces of people that I've heard about from my parents and other people around the town to join. We'll get back to actually talking about the wall because a lot of my research this summer focused on the wall, so we'll get to that at the end of the presentation. But before I begin, I just wanted to, one, tell you all that I'm happy to answer questions, and we'll have a discussion after I finish my report that will be moderated by Kathy Roberts. And I wanted to give you guys a little bit of a sense of who I am and what growing up here in Lincoln meant to me. So Jane spoke about knowing me from before I was even born. And I was born and raised here in Lincoln and a graduate of the Lincoln Public Schools. And despite not being a WASP, I joke, I thought I was a WASP until I was told I had to have a bat mitzvah when I was 13. I did have a tremendous amount of pride about growing up in a place where the American Revolutionary War started. Mr. Hicks is here. He's a Minuteman. And I always was a little bit jealous of my friends who got to participate in that. Because there's something about the revolutionary spirit in Lincoln that really captivated me. The idea that people here were willing to sacrifice and fight for their freedom and to fight for a government that represented them. And that's something that, a piece of Lincoln that actually I carry with me and think about wherever I travel. So thank you to all the folks here in Lincoln who have helped to have that impact on me. After I graduated from LS in 2006, I moved to New York and graduated from Columbia in 2010 with a degree in political science. My dad mentioned I first traveled to Israel-Palestine in 2007, and I returned there in 2008 for 10 weeks working for two organizations, one on each side of the wall or on the Green Line, one Palestinian and one Israeli. And from there, my interest in this issue really grew and developed. And as my father mentioned, I've been back there 10 times and have continued to work on this issue both here in the States. I spent 3 years working for a U.S.-based NGO that was organizing Israelis and Palestinians around a two-state solution. And then last fall, I returned to law school with the aim of continuing my activism and advocacy work, but through a legal perspective. And so I just returned on Monday, from 12 weeks in Palestine, the majority of which was spent in Bethlehem. So I apologize if I lose at my spot. I still am a bit jet-lagged and getting accustomed to being back on Eastern time. But Thank you all for coming. So I'm curious, how many people in this audience have been to Israel or Palestine? So we have a pretty good amount. So that's good. I'm going to run through a quick kind of summary of history just to bring people up to speed, very cursory, before I get into talking about some of the things I experienced this summer and the work that I was doing. So Palestine was under Ottoman rule for centuries up until the early 20th century. And it was in 1917, prior to the end of World War I, that Great Britain issued the Balfour Declaration stating its support for the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Just a year later, in 1918, the Sykes-Picot Agreement actually granted British rule over Mandate Palestine. But following World War II, the British decided that they would give up control of Palestine and hand it over to the newly established United Nations. The UN recommended partitioning Palestine. There's a map of the partition over here on your left, into two states, one Arab for the Palestinian indigenous residents and one for the Jews. At that time, the population was 32% Jewish and 68% Palestinian. But this decision to partition the land was without consulting the local indigenous folks who were living there. And the land was actually allocated, with 56% of the territory being allocated to the Jews, who were a minority, and 43% being allocated to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians would have made up a sizable minority within that Jewish state, while the Jewish settlements in what would have been the Palestinian state numbered very few. Following the UN vote to partition Palestine, and prior to Israel's declaration of independence in May of 1948, the Jewish militias inside of Mandate Palestine started expelling Palestinians from their villages, and there were clashes, and over 2 years of hostilities, more than 750,000 Palestinians were forced out of their land or fled their land and became a refugee population. In December of 1948, the UN issued Resolution 194, which called not only for a return of all refugees who are willing to live in peace with their neighbors, and to have them return home at the earliest practicable date, but also that those who weren't able to return home or who had lost or damaged property should be compensated. It's important to note that to this day, nearly 70 years later, no Palestinian has been allowed to return home, and no one has been compensated for what they had lost. In 1949, there was an armistice agreement between Israel, the newly established state of Israel, and the neighboring Arab countries, which had been at war with it. And the West Bank, including the eastern part of Jerusalem, was controlled by the Jordanians, and the Gaza Strip was controlled by the Egyptians, with the remainder of the land, 78% of historic Palestine, being part of the newly established Jewish state. In 1967, Israel invaded and occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, which was later returned in a peace deal with Egypt, and the Golan Heights was also captured from Syria, and that's been annexed. Almost within a few years, Israel had annexed the eastern part of the city of Jerusalem, declaring it unified and making it its capital. And despite this unilateral annexation, it hasn't been recognized by the majority of the international community, and the Palestinian residents who are living there were never granted citizenship or equal rights under Israeli law.
Mentioning the 67 war.
I just mentioned the 67 war.
You just said Israel annexed such and such.
I said Israel invaded and occupied.
Yeah, right. But that was not an unfortunate.
Okay. Can you hold your questions till the end, please?
Well, that was so outrageous that I couldn't.
Please.
All right. We can discuss this in the Q&A afterwards. So almost immediately after the war, Israel began establishing settlements in the West Bank and also in Gaza. They've since removed the settlements from Gaza. These are towns and cities and villages, some of which are established by the Israeli government, some of which are established by private citizens. I'll talk a little bit more about them when I talk about living in Bethlehem. But what's important to note is that the establishment of these communities is in direct contravention of international law. The Fourth Geneva Convention, which establishes the rules of war, the laws of war, explicitly states that an occupying power can neither transfer its civilian population into the occupied, the territories in which it occupies, nor can the occupied civilian population be transferred out of their homes, unless for military imperative or the safety of those civilians. And those those are meant to be temporary evacuations of the civilians in order and not meant to be permanent. Today, there are over 500,000 Israeli settlers living in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and dozens of Israeli settlements. Despite UN criticism and international criticism, and UN resolutions for that matter, Israel continues to establish settlements. And most recently this week, the Israeli Supreme Court declared that a bunch of land south of Bethlehem was that's Palestinian land is actually Israeli state land, and that's going to clear the way for an additional 800 housing units. So this is happening today. And what's important to note, oftentimes we look at these settlements and the issue of moving Israeli civilians in, but one of the things that I was focusing on this summer is actually the Palestinians who are displaced in order to make way for these settlements. It's also important to note that the settlements aren't the occupation itself. They're merely a symptom of it. And today, in addition to talking about the issue of settlements, I'll also talk about the checkpoints and the impact of the wall, other symptoms of occupation. So I'd like to give you a glimpse of my life in Bethlehem and talk to you a little bit about what the research I was doing at Bentil. But first I'll just show you a little bit about Bethlehem. So Bethlehem is an ancient city, probably most famous because it's the birthplace of Jesus. And this is the Church of the Nativity up here, the exterior of it, and the interior of the church, which is built where it's believed that Jesus was born. Historically, it's a Christian city, though now it's majority Muslim. And but the neighboring towns of Beit Sahor and Beit Jala, which are seen as kind of part of the Bethlehem metropolis, are still majority Christian. It's known for being exceptionally tolerant and peaceful, and for having kind of a leftist, progressive political slant. The particularly Beit Sahor was known during the First Intifada for its creative, nonviolent resistance. Maybe you heard there was a film that came out last year about how the town actually hid 18 cows, which they were using so that they could produce their own dairy products and not be dependent on Israeli products during the First Intifada. And the army searched all over for these 18 cows. The film's called The Wanted 18. Just like every major Palestinian city, Bethlehem has a university. It's called Bethlehem University. And there's also a newly established Museum of Natural History, which hundreds of thousands of dollars have been invested in. And it's chronicling a lot of the native species that are native to Palestine and documenting the biodiversity inside of Palestine. The city is also home to three refugee camps, Al-Aza and Aida, and Dehesha Camp, Dehesha being the largest, Al-Aza being the smallest. And those house tens of thousands of refugees, both from 1948 and their descendants. And you can see here, it has a vibrant old city. The skyline is beautiful. And also has artwork from famous graffiti artists like Banksy all over the city. But despite its idyllic atmosphere and ancient history and biblical significance, it's not immune from the occupation. This photo is grainy. I took it on July 28th at 10:17 p.m., I was walking to the checkpoint to cross into Jerusalem. It It's only a few miles from Jerusalem, but it's cut off by the wall and checkpoints. And I had been warned, oh, the soldiers were in the city. This city, by the way, is under the Oslo agreements, meant to be under complete Palestinian control. But the army is in almost every night. So on this night, I happened to be turning left to go towards the checkpoints, and a dozen soldiers in full combat gear emerged and really frightened me. So I grabbed a taxi and found one, and they drove me by. And you can see, you can just make out here in the left side of the photo, a couple of the soldiers in their combat gear and a couple of Palestinian youth standing there being hassled by them. And they're standing in front of the separation and annexation wall. And this isn't uncommon. Soldiers invade the city nightly. They're near my house. Probably this photo was taken probably about the same distance from here as the Old Town Hall exchanges from the library. Just Saturday morning before I left at 4:30, I had to get up and run and close all the windows in the house because of the tear gas seeping in. It's common. And the city itself is in a better situation than the refugee camps. A number of my colleagues in Bethlehem live in the refugee camps. About a month before I left, one colleague's cousin was shot in the knee with live ammunition in Dehesha refugee camp. And in a two-week period, it was estimated that 17 youth from the camp had been shot in the legs. And this wasn't unexpected because the military commander had actually threatened a number of young men from the camp when they were being interrogated during arrests in the weeks prior. This is the view from my apartment. I live just one floor below. And it was a spectacular view. You can see Beit Sahor off to the right. And I just want to point out on the far right of the photo, the water tanks. Bethlehem isn't hooked up to a water system, so we're reliant on tanks on the roof in order to ensure that we have water. And so this tank was actually my cold water, and this one was my hot water. And sometimes we didn't have water, and there were people I know who didn't have water for up to 40 days this summer. There was a day I walked into Jerusalem and saw a man power washing the sidewalk, and I thought, oh, that's where the water is. But one thing that you probably wouldn't notice unless you had a trained eye is this off in the distance. This is Har Homa, one of the settlements that's considered to be part of Jerusalem, according to the Israelis. It's an Israeli settlement that's built on Palestinian land that was expropriated in 1991, and it was constructed in the late 1990s after then and now current Prime Minister Netanyahu approved its construction. This is just one of dozens of settlements and outposts that's been established by the Israeli government and also by private citizens. These settlements are not only built on Palestinian land, but they're also frequently built on privately owned Palestinian land. And frequently the rightful landowners have little recourse in terms of getting their land returned to them or even being compensated. Life in the settlements, from what I understand, is pretty nice. You see here in the foreground of this photo, all of the water tanks on the Palestinian buildings. I took this photo right down the street from where I was working, about a 5-minute walk from my apartment. And here there are no water tanks because these settlements are hooked up to the Israeli infrastructure. They have water lines, no issues with electricity, and they even have their own roads so that settlers don't have to drive through Palestinian roads. These roads are forbidden for Palestinian use. And they're pretty convenient. You drive right under Palestinian land. This, I believe, is in Beit Jala, right next to Bethlehem. And you're able to get to Jerusalem in 10 minutes. This is in stark contrast to the experience that Palestinians have. I also should note, before I forget, that this settlement, Har Homa, is part of a strategy to encircle the eastern part of Jerusalem, cutting off Palestinian communities inside of the West Bank from East Jerusalem and creating a division. And so this was part of that strategy. So Israelis have this easy access road to get into Jerusalem and make the commute But Palestinians don't have it so easy. They have to go through checkpoints in order to get into Jerusalem. And in order to even get to through one of those checkpoints, you frequently need a permit. And every person, it's like going through an airport. Every person has their has to remove their belt, anything that's in their pockets, put all of their belongings through an X-ray machine. They walk through a metal detector. They must show their ID or permit to the soldiers who are waiting there. And they're subject to frequent delays. So I just want to explain to you a couple of these photos and the context in which I took them. The photo on the top left is from checkpoint 300. I took the, it's the main checkpoint that leads from Bethlehem into Jerusalem. I took this photo at 6 a.m. on a Friday morning. I had to cross to get to Ramallah on the other, which is north of Jerusalem. Bethlehem is south of Jerusalem. And unfortunately, because it was the Muslim day of rest, there was no public transport that could take me around the hour and a half road that cuts, that goes all the way around Jerusalem in the Mahale Adumim settlement, and I had to take a bus into Jerusalem and from there a bus to Ramallah. It's a 12-mile distance, and it took me about an hour and 45 minutes.
Excuse me, what's that man doing up there?
Yeah, so this man, what it, the story is that it's so crowded, you're in a corridor that's about 5 feet wide, and it, and there's no space, and people want to cut in line, they're in a hurry to get to work. Or go, most of these people are workers actually, going who have permits to go and work inside of Israel. And so he was climbing up. It's not an uncommon sight to see when the checkpoint is so crowded, people climbing up, literally on climbing the walls in order to cut in line. I have to say, I was quite lucky that day. I walked in, had no idea it would be so crowded that late in the morning, because most of the workers leave for work around 4 a.m., and it was a Friday, so I assumed it wouldn't be so busy. And as soon as these men saw me, they immediately knew I was a foreigner. They knew I was a woman, obviously. And they yelled out in front of them, "Clear the path for the girl! Clear the path for the girl!" And it was like simultaneously walking a gauntlet with all of these eyes on me, but also like Moses parting the Red Sea and just walking straight to the front. And on a normal day, I wouldn't have done it, but I was in a big rush and quite thankful. These other two photos are from Colombia checkpoint, Ramallah. I also want to note, except for the maps, all of these photos I took, most of them this summer. And so this is Colombia checkpoint on the top right and on the bottom. And that's the main checkpoint to get from Ramallah into Jerusalem. And as an American citizen, I'm very privileged to be able to walk up, show my American passport, show my 3-month tourist visa, and go through. So one day, it was taking about an hour. It was 90 degrees out. It was taking about an hour to go through. The lines weren't moving. There weren't that many people there, just the lines weren't moving. And all of a sudden, I heard a familiar accent. It was American English. And the person who was yelling was quite upset. And it turned out that it was a Palestinian-American couple who was going to Jerusalem. It was right before Ramadan started. I don't know what the occasion was, whether they wanted to go to the holy sites or do shopping before Ramadan or just go to the beach because it was so hot. But because they had dual citizenship, both a Palestinian ID and an American passport, they were forbidden to cross the checkpoint. Their American citizenship literally means nothing to the Israeli authorities, and the American government refuses to do anything to advocate on behalf of the rights of their own citizens and ensure that they're treated equally under the law. Just to give you an idea of the number of checkpoints, according to B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights organization, there are not, as of April of last year, there were 96 checkpoints in the West Bank, 57 of which were internal, inside the West Bank, between Palestinian cities, preventing or delaying Palestinians from getting from city to city. 37 of the fixed checkpoints are the last inspection point before entering Israel, but many of them are not fixed on that 1949 armistice line or the Green Line. They're further inside in the Palestinian territory. Some of them are manned by soldiers, and some are manned by private contractors. who are paid by the Israeli government to man the checkpoints. And in addition to the ones that are fixed, as of April of last year, there were 361 flying checkpoints in the month of April. That means they're not permanent. They're just put up on the side of the road at a moment's notice and stop cars or people at random and search them. But it's not just the checkpoints in Bethlehem that you face. It's also the wall. And the wall, in some cases, is an electric fence. In some cases, like in Bethlehem, it's a very tall concrete wall. There's a watchtower in this photo where one day I had a soldier kind of bored and waving at me saying, "Hey." And when I asked someone about it, they said, "Oh yeah, he did that to everyone all day." And then here, I went to the one Chinese restaurant inside of Bethlehem, which is surprisingly decent. And this was the view from the restaurant. It's literally surrounded by the wall. And the wall really cuts into the city and goes right up to the municipal boundaries, preventing Bethlehem from expanding or growing and providing more space for settlement growth and de facto annexing these settlements. And I'll show you a map in a bit when I talk about the research I did with Badil that shows the route of the wall. But the wall does not fall on the border. In fact, it frequently cuts deep into the Palestinian territory. And this is what's de facto annexing a number of the settlements, not all, but the majority of the settlements. But in addition to that, it's also separating Palestinian communities from each other. I did want to note that in 2004, the International Court of Justice issued an advisory opinion that declared the parts of the wall not on the Green Line to be illegal and disproportionate. And I just want to quote, because I think it can sum it up better than I could, what their views on this wall were. So they said, "To sum up, the court, from the material available to it, is not convinced that the specific course Israel has chosen for the wall was necessary to attain its security objectives. The wall, along the route chosen, and its associated regime gravely infringe a number of rights of Palestinians residing in the territory occupied by Israel. And the infringements resulting from that route cannot be justified by military exigencies or by the requirements of national security or public order. The construction of such a wall accordingly constitutes breaches by Israel of various of its obligations under the applicable international humanitarian and human rights instruments." Since this decision was issued, there have been some parts of the wall that have been altered, but parts of it have not been moved to the Green Line. And the wall actually is twice the length of the Green Line, so it really weaves its way in and out around the territory. Israel attests that this wall is meant for security, and sure enough, in 2002, there was a lot of violence coming from the Palestinian territory. There was also a lot of violence coming from the Israeli army as well. But the wall is not what ended this violence. It was clearly a strategic decision made by the Palestinian leadership to end armed struggle. And we know this because today there are tens of thousands of Palestinians that are working illegally inside of Israel and jumping the wall. I have friends who have jumped the wall and go and work there illegally. And Israel knows this. It's not a secret. They know that there's this part of their economy of the same way we do here in the United States.
Are they endangering their lives if they do this?
Yes, it is endangering. It can be dangerous for Palestinians if they're caught jumping the wall. But there are known routes that people take and smugglers that they pay. I mean, it's very similar to our southern border, the situation on our southern border. But there hasn't been an effort by Israel to combat the illegal workers inside of Israel. And in fact, as you might imagine, those workers are frequently exploited because they have no legal recourse because they're there illegally. The wall, in addition to having this impact on the landscape, just has an impact on society as a whole. It cuts communities off from each other, and it stifles economic growth. And there's a psychological impact. Living in Bethlehem is like living in a ghetto. It's terrifying to have to feel that surveillance looking down on you when you're walking down the street. And I'll talk a little bit more about how the wall has affected specific communities when I get to talking about my research at Bedil. So Bedil is a local Palestinian NGO based in Bethlehem. It has about 10 to 15 employees, most of whom are local Palestinians from the Bethlehem area. It was founded in 1998. And it was founded as an independent nonprofit organization to protect and promote Palestinian refugee and internally displaced persons' rights. And the mission and programs that Bedil executes are all rooted in the principles of international human rights law. And this summer, I had the opportunity to research and document some of the issues regarding forcible transfer, which is a war crime. And the effort really is to continue building this case of human rights violations and to hold the Israeli perpetrators and authorities accountable for this. So this summer, the majority of my work was spent drafting two chapters on a report on forcible transfer that's going to be submitted in the coming months to the International Criminal Court. So I just want to give you a little bit of background about what forcible transfer is and how we conducted our research. So as I mentioned earlier, international law prohibits the transfer of an occupying power to transfer its civilian population into a territory, but also prohibits the occupying power from transferring a civilian population off their land or out of their homes. There are very few exceptions, and I mentioned earlier, those are for military, out of military necessity, or for the safety of the civilians. And in both those cases, the evacuations are intended to be temporary, not permanent. Most of the time, the international community is focused on the settlements and condemning the settlement expansion, but what we most often overlook is actually the people who are displaced in order to make way for those settlements to expand. And that's why this report that we were working on this summer is so important, because it looked at a number of different communities within the Palestinian territory who are being forcibly displaced. That's not to say that every Palestinian who is displaced from their land meets the threshold for being forcibly transferred, but there are a number that have, and the international community doesn't often use the appropriate legal language to discuss what's happening there. So the way we worked at Bedil this summer, we created a legal framework that defined what forcible transfer is, and we looked mostly at the International Criminal Tribunal of Yugoslavia, in which there were a number of cases of forcible transfer. And so there are these three elements that must be met in order to have a prima facie or a case of forcible transfer. So that's the forced displacement of protected persons by expulsion or other forms of coercion. And when we look at the cases from the ICTY, from the International Criminal Tribunal in Yugoslavia, we see that it's not necessary that a person be forced out of their home at gunpoint. It can be as simple as taking advantage of a coercive environment. And in this case, what we found is that the Israeli authorities frequently create an environment that is so coercive that Palestinians have no choice but to leave their home. And so they must be displaced from areas in which they were lawfully present, but remaining within a national border. So they'd be defined as like internally displaced persons, as opposed to refugees who are forced outside of their national border. And then the removal is taking place without grounds permitted by international law. And those are those two exceptions that I spoke about: the temporary evacuation for the safety of a civilian population, or for the imperative of a military operation. But there are no armed hostilities actively taking place right now in the Palestinian territory in the West Bank. So I won't be able to talk about both the chapters I drafted this summer, so I wanted to talk about one in particular, which goes back to the wall, and that's the case of communities living in the seam zones. Now, the seam zones are these areas. This is the red line is the route of the wall, and you can see it doesn't follow the whole West Bank, the whole Green Line or Armistice Line border. It cuts deeply, in some cases,
yeah.
into the Palestinian territory. And so there are about 11,000 people who currently live inside those areas. And they aren't the only ones who are affected. It's not only the residents. It's also business owners and farmers, because there's a lot of farmland in that area. And those people are living under tremendous pressure. In order to continue residing in those areas, they have to apply for a permanent residency ID. And in order to get that, they have to go through a long, arduous process. It's the process is only written in Hebrew. It's not transparent at all. Frequently, you have to just go kind of by trial and error, or you have to hire an expensive Israeli attorney to help you get the permit, or the alternative is to rely on local NGOs who can help you navigate the system, but those have limited resources and can't often devote the amount of time and energy that each person deserves. So living in the seam zone, the wall, and the associated permit regime that goes along with it intrudes on all aspects of day-to-day activities. It cripples the economy and has led to a rise in poverty. There's little or there's inadequate or non-existent health and education and sanitation amenities. For some food essentials like dairy and eggs, you have to get a permit to just bring them into those areas. And the Palestinian Ministry of Education has even been restricted in delivering books and furniture to the schools in those areas. Additionally, there's issues in terms of allowing ambulances and cars to get in. You hear stories about Palestinian women who will leave the villages weeks in advance of delivering because they're afraid that if they go into labor, they won't be able to make it into a hospital in time. In order for the people to enter and exit, they must have a permit and they have to go through a checkpoint. Those permits only allow them to enter the seam zone that they reside in, so somebody living south of Jerusalem wouldn't be able to use their permit to enter a seam zone in the north. And the toll on human life, it's not just this feeling of isolation or lack of services, but it's also inconvenience. I was reading in one Israeli Supreme Court case where they were complimenting or praising the military on how they'd improved the wait time at a checkpoint in Barta Ashrikiya, which is way up here in the north of the West Bank. And they said that now wait times at the checkpoint have been cut down. It's only 10 minutes during rush hour. And 5 minutes when there isn't so much traffic. Now, I did a little back-of-the-envelope calculation and thought about, well, if somebody is going to work or school 5 days a week, twice a day, let's say we'll split the difference and have it be an average of 7.5 minutes a day, or 7.5 minutes each trip, times twice a day, 52 weeks a year, it's 3,900 minutes, which is 65 hours. That's nearly 3 days that the people living in that community are forced to wait at a checkpoint in order to go about their daily business. But it's not just this, it's also a social impact. People can't have friends and family visit. It's difficult to have people come if there's a funeral or a wedding. Weddings are frequently held outside the seam zones. And for funerals, people are only typically allowed in on the first day of the funeral and not for the subsequent mourning days. And people are also reluctant to have marriages between people who are inside the seam zone and people who are outside. Because if somebody from inside the seam zone marries someone from outside and decides to move outside the seam zone, they might not be able to get a permit to go back and visit their family. Or if somebody does move into the seam zone, first of all, the process of getting permanent residency can take months. And second of all, then they'll be isolated from their family and friends, and they won't be able to be visited. But it's not just the people for permanent residency who are required to get permits. There are actually 13 different permits to enter the seam zones. And those permits are for different things. And if you want to do more than one thing inside of the seam zone, you have to get multiple permits. So if you operate a business in the seam zone, and you also say you want to get married to a person who lives inside of the seam zone, you're required to get two different permits to enter the same place. And if you're found to be using your permit for purposes not stipulated in the permit, you can face up to 5 years of prison. Yeah. Most of the permits are valid only for 3 months, but they can last up to 2 years. And they aren't automatically renewed, and you can't renew your permit until it expires. So there are these lapses where people aren't able to access the areas that they're trying to reach. Between 2007 and 2009, there was actually a 25% decrease in permit holders, meaning that fewer people were getting permits, but there was the same number of permits issued, which indicates that actually there's the permits are being issued for less time. And the fact that fewer people are receiving them indicates that people are being displaced from those areas or unable to continue to operate their businesses or access their farmland. A lot of this land is farmland, and farmers must prove ownership of the land in order to be able to access their crops. Sometimes they don't have the proper paperwork or don't know what the proper way paperwork is, or they might not have enough land to actually qualify to get a permit to access the land. And according to the UN, between 2000 and 2014, half of all permits to go in and access that farmland were denied. In 2018, there were 81 gates to access farmland. Only 9 of them were open daily, 9 of them were open weekly, and the remaining 63 were only open during the olive harvest season, which lasts about 4 to 6 weeks in October and November. What this means is that farmers aren't able to go and access their land and take care of their crops. So there's been a big transition from high intensity and high yield crops to lower intensity crops that require less care and maintenance. But even when they've made that transition, the olive trees, for example, inside of the seam zones only produce about 40 to 60% less than the olive trees on the opposite side of the wall inside of the West Bank. And so it's had a devastating impact on a number of the farmers this isn't a hobby, it's not Codman Farm. These are people who are dependent on their farms for their livelihood. And then in addition to the farmers and the residents, if you have a business in the seam zone, you also have to apply for permits. And you have, in order to receive the permit, you have to show that area is necessary to your business. So if you operate a store, a furniture store, for example, that has branches all around the West Bank, and one of them happens to be in the seam zone, they might decide that one isn't necessary for you to operate your business, and you might not get it. And so, and for business owners, they're only able to get permits that last for a year, and 6 months for each employee. So it takes a long time to go through this paperwork, and oftentimes it's just too difficult to continue doing it. So what we found in conducting this research is that, in this case, there is forcible transfer. Life is impossible for people to maintain any degree of normalcy, and they really have no choice because of this coercive environment but to leave. We had one case study that's being included in the report of a woman who was from a seam zone and had a sick child. First of all, they were unable to get building permits to expand their home to accommodate the size of their family. But her child also was sick. And because of this, she felt that she had to leave the village, isolate herself from her family and friends and everyone she knew, and go live in another town in order to guarantee medical access for her child. So this is just one example of the way in which the wall, the permit regime, and the checkpoints, and also the subsequent growth of settlements, is impacting Palestinian lives and continuing with the displacement of Palestinians that began with the 750,000 refugees in 1948. and is continuing through today. So unfortunately, we have limited time, but I do want to thank everyone for coming. I hope that this is not the end of a discussion about Israel-Palestine and Lincoln, but rather is the beginning.
You have been listening to A Report from Bethlehem by Shana Lowe, who spent the summer with the Palestinian NGO Badil as a legal intern. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.